Today's episode is sponsored by Empower. It doesn't matter how much money you have, we all have money questions. Empower has the tech with a real-time dashboard and the people to help you take control of your financial future and empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Lauren.
Mike.
What goes through your head when you see a text message come in for me?
Like, I'm like, from... oh, yay.
No, I mean like from my Android phone to your iPhone, and then like I show up as a green bubble.
Oh, when we're using SMS?
Yes.
I think it'd be really nice if Mike had an iPhone. But we don't, we text over Signal all the time.
We do. We use Signal primarily because it's more secure, but also because whenever you send me a video, it looks normal instead of all crunchy and terrible like it would if we just use SMS.
Right. Yeah, it's true. The third-party app thing is so much better. But we can't have nice messaging by default. We just can't have nice things.
Is that really the basis, though, for a massive antitrust lawsuit?
Aha, I knew you were getting there. We should talk about it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Gadget Lab. I'm Michael Calori, Director of Consumer Tech and Culture at Wired.
And I'm Lauren Good. I'm a senior writer at Wired.
We are also joined once again by Wired's senior security editor, Andrew Kautz. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Thank you for joining us from your Hamlet, Andrew.
You're very welcome. It's very Hamlet-y.
Today, we are talking about Apple. Late last week, the U.S. Department of Justice filed an antitrust lawsuit against Apple. In the suit, the DOJ accuses Apple of establishing a, quote, iPhone monopoly, unquote, by locking certain features and services into iOS. This walled garden approach is one that Apple uses for many of its products, including its subscription services, its wearables business, and its financial services offerings. The DOJ's argument is that if you don't have an iPhone, you just can't use a lot of the stuff that Apple makes, which is not only unfair, but it also just locks people into Apple's ecosystem. So Andrew, you and our colleague Andy Greenberg co-authored a story on Wired about the intricacies of this antitrust lawsuit and its security implications. I did not write an article about it, so the overview that I just gave was very brief. So I'm hoping that you can fill out the story for us. What are the particulars of the suit, and where is the DOJ really putting the screws to Apple?
Sure. So broadly speaking, the antitrust suit accuses Apple of being a monopoly and engaging in anti-competitive behavior. Part of that anti-competitive behavior, the DOJ alleges, is that Apple's decision to not allow interoperability of iMessage between Apple devices and Android devices is part of that anti-competitive behavior. Specifically, they're referring to the encryption that's allowed through iMessage between different iPhones, but that's not afforded to Android users. If you're chatting with somebody on Android, like you, Michael, to Lauren, then those messages are not encrypted. It's just standard SMS. And so part of the lawsuit is Apple's decision to keep the encryption for itself, essentially. The DOJ also alleges that Apple selectively chooses when to embrace security and privacy and when to not. And specifically, it says that it does so only when it benefits Apple itself. So it might keep iMessage encryption for itself, but it makes Google, which engages in a lot of data collection, the default search engine on Safari on its devices. And so the DOJ describes it in its lawsuit as an elastic implementation of privacy and security decisions.
That's a good word.
And what is the market competition argument for how Apple is being unfair, for lack of a better word, in the way that it builds its privacy and security services and sort of doesn't extend them, right? Like the DOJ can't make an argument that Apple should do that out of goodwill. It's alleging a monopoly because of the way that Apple wields this tech. What's the strongest argument there?
I would say the actual weakest part of the DOJ argument is that Apple is a monopoly. From the experts we spoke to, defining Apple as having monopoly power over the market is the biggest challenge for the DOJ in this lawsuit. And of course, that is central to its success. If a smaller company were to offer privacy features or security features that it doesn't extend to all of its competitors, that might not be a problem. It's simply Apple's size, the DOJ alleges, that makes its decisions to keep certain security and privacy decisions to itself a problem. And so really, in writing the piece that Andy and I did, we struggled with how to describe exactly what the issues were here, because really you want to have companies competing to have the best privacy and security options available if you want to further privacy and security. But because of Apple's size, it's able to wield undue influence over the market generally, according to the DOJ. And the experts we spoke to say Apple really shouldn't be the one setting the standards for privacy and security.
So you got a statement out of Apple, and Lauren, I know you've done some reporting on this too. What is their stance? How is the reaction to this lawsuit being messaged?
More generally, Apple sees it as false, and that they are simply practicing their business and doing it well. With iMessage specifically, they say they could offer an Android version of it that would allow both Android and iPhone users to have the encryption currently only offered to iPhone users. However, they say they can't guarantee that the implementation of the encryption would be up to Apple standards. And there is some legitimacy to that argument. Encryption is a notoriously difficult technology to implement correctly. And if it isn't implemented correctly, there could be security or privacy issues for users. So there's some legitimacy to that argument. But at the same time, there are certainly ways that Apple could require specific implementation, just as WhatsApp has done with the ways it's expanding its interoperability options to make sure that the encryption is implemented correctly.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was going to add, not just in response to this DOJ lawsuit, but in general, one of Apple's biggest arguments around messaging has been, well, provided that the app is in the App Store, you can install any messaging app you want. You can install Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, Line, Signal, as we referenced early on. Of course, that isn't the default message, right? So if you just go to dash off a text to a friend from your primary, like your contacts app or something embedded in the native phone system, it's going to default to SMS. But some of those apps are end-to-end encrypted and sort of meet the higher security standards, and you could just use them
yeah.
the way that we use Signal.
It does require both people to have the same app.
Right. You have to have the same app container. You have to both opt in.
Right. And that's difficult to do. Where mm-hmm. like we're journalists who work in technology, we can say like, hey, let's use Signal. But to explain to like your normie friends who are not journalists and who are not as familiar with encryption technology, hey, let's use Signal. Well, what is that? And then you end up being the one person who they can't text because you have to go into this weird app to text them. So it's a very imperfect solution.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, also, I do agree that it's probably likely that Apple can come up with a way to properly implement end-to-end encryption on its iMessage platform in a way that allows it to be used cross-platform, right? Apple has also recently said that they're going to support RCS, mm-hmm. which is a new text standard. Can you talk about that a little bit, Lauren?
Yeah, RCS is something that Google has really been a big proponent of. And Google is also working with the wireless networks to create and ensure this standard. So, I mean, I think maybe what some consumers who are just have been on iPhone for a long time and just fire off blue bubble texts to each other, like maybe don't realize is that when Apple created iMessage as extensions of earlier products like iChat, it was basically eschewing the traditional wireless networks. It was using its own data network and its own privacy and security, which is different from the packets of data that were being sent over wireless networks, which could be monitored in different mm-hmm. ways. And so that was part of, you know, Apple's value proposition with iMessage. Google has come out and said, we think we can make a rich communication service, RCS, that we can get all of the big players in the mobile phone and wireless world on board with, that would allow some of the more fun or interactive features of messaging to happen cross-platform. So things like giving a tap back on a friend's message, or using certain emoji or videos or gifts, or actually just sending your friends a photo or video and not have it be this terrible compressed format if it's going from Android to Apple or Apple to Android. Like Google said, like, we can make this happen. We just need everyone on board. On top of that, we would offer an end-to-end encryption that would rival what Apple is essentially offering on iMessage. Apple said at some point last year that they would hop aboard the RCS train this year, but we have no clarity on that. No updates on that. We don't know when it's going to happen.
Yeah. And I think when that announcement came, it was also widely believed to be something that was going to be used in the future as like a chip against a possible antitrust lawsuit over iMessage encryption.
Correct.
So it was maybe like a strategic, okay, we'll support it now.
Yes.
Kind of thing that
yes.
didn't necessarily stop the lawsuit from coming down.
Yeah, the big tech companies are very good at playing 4D chess.
Hopefully, they can get better at interoperability. All right, let's take a quick break and we'll come right back. Empower has the tech that can help get your money questions answered. What is your net worth? Are you saving enough? Are you on track for retirement? With the free and easy to use Empower Personal Dashboard, you can see your net worth, plan out your retirement age, track spending, create budgets, and more. And if you need a technology break, get a free second opinion by having a real live conversation with one of Empower's financial professionals to get clarity on your real life financial goals. Join 18 million Americans in Empower and take control of your financial future to empower what's next. Download the free app for Apple or Android now, or check out empower.com. Now, Lauren, you also wrote a story about this DOJ lawsuit, a very good story that outlines the cultural argument that the government is making. The DOJ alleges that Apple, through user experience design in iOS, gives the impression that Android phones are inferior to iPhones. The DOJ suit also alleges that this artificial stigma ends up creating a social pressure that forces people to switch to iPhones or to just keep buying iPhones until the end of time. How is the Department of Justice saying this social pressure works?
I mean, won't anyone think of the teenagers in their group chats? Okay, so we have to go back a little bit to around 2022, and this anecdote is included in the DOJ's 88-page filing. Tim Cook was speaking at a conference, the annual Code Conference. He was on stage with Laureen Powell Jobs, Steve Jobs' widow, and Johnny Ive. And someone in the audience talked to Tim, asked Tim about the pain point that he was experiencing in sending images and videos and stuff to his mom on Android. And Tim Cook's now infamous response was, "Get your mom an iPhone." So he didn't really offer a solution that was cross-platform. He just, you know, he made a sales pitch. That anecdote is included because it is supposedly emblematic of how painful it can be to actually use cross-platform messaging. That same year, the Wall Street Journal had written a story about how teens were feeling ostracized, just terrible about the fact that if they had an Android phone and they were part of a group chat, their friends would accuse them of quote-unquote breaking the chat, which I think a lot of us have seen happen.
Yep.
So this is a social stigma argument. It's a bit spurious. It is a cultural argument that by establishing the technical differences between iMessage and Android, that Apple is making rival smartphones worse. It is a bit of a strange argument, right? Because it's a free market that, you know, these tech companies are operating in, and Apple may be making a superior product, but it veers away from kind of the traditional definitions and more recondite explanations of antitrust, right? Which are typically looking at things like super competitive pricing or whether or not a company is doing something sort of behind the scenes to restrict competition in a way that changes market pricing. In this instance, it's really this kind of this social stigma argument. The DOJ is arguing that all of this reinforces the so-called switching costs that Apple has baked into its phones, and it makes Apple that much more dominant. And that is what makes it anti-competitive.
I see. I mean, those things are real, right?
Like, they are.
As an Android phone person, I often get blamed for breaking the chat, and I have to correct them and say, no, don't blame me, blame Apple. I often get blamed for sending crappy videos and people say, what's wrong with your phone? And I say, there's nothing wrong with my phone. There's something wrong with your phones. Mm-hmm. The fun part is when it's reversed and there's a lot of Android people and there's one iPhone person in the chat. And then all of a sudden they're the odd person out and they don't know what's happening because usually they're in a world where they're only chatting with other people with iPhones. So there's a lot of people who are just like not aware that this is even an issue. Right. Because so many people in their circle have iPhones.
Right. Or this is a very U.S. centric problem, too.
How so?
Well, overseas, Android is the most dominant operating system in the world, not just on mobile, but Android. You know, there are many forked versions of Androids that exist on things like set-top boxes and ATMs. And cars and ATMs. Exactly. Your Peloton, right? And around the world, people tend to gravitate towards different messaging apps, WhatsApp, WeChat. I mentioned Line earlier. There are all kinds of... So this is very much a U.S. problem. Now, granted, the DOJ suit is happening here in the United States. I think you're correct in that this does happen to a lot of people, and maybe just consumers don't really understand why or place the blame where they shouldn't. In my family chat, there's one person who has an Android phone. Everyone else has an iPhone. And so for a while, the tapbacks have gotten better. But for a while, a lot of people probably have noticed this. The tapback would be written out in text.
Yes.
So if you liked someone's message, it would say, you know, Jack liked a message or something.
It says loved a message.
Loved a message. And well, there's liked and love. There's the thumbs up. And then
Sorry. I only know love.
I don't know the tapbacks. Yeah. and my teenage niece and nephew for a long time would just make fun of us by typing out their tapbacks.
I do that.
It was just there are cultural norms now that have been established, all on account of the fact that some people are using green bubbles and some people are using blue bubbles. The question is whether or not this is legally defensible. And right. To Andrew's point, a lot of the experts who we've spoken with in recent days say that this is probably not the most legally defensible. One legal expert I spoke to said that the DOJ is probably going to have to come forward with more documentation, internal emails or the like, that indicate that this goes beyond social stigma. This is Apple has been so concerned about market competition in some ways, or so concerned about threats to its ecosystem, that it has taken dubious action in some way.
Right. Like it has to show that this is a strategy,
right,
for the company to get a leg up. Andrew, what are your thoughts about pain points around messaging?
I just wish fewer people would text me, just generally. Just all the notifications are so exhausting. That's neither here nor there about what Apple's doing. But I was getting overwhelmed thinking about how many pings a day I'm having to deal with. And I think that's exacerbated by the fact that we're all switching around through various different apps. Like, people will be messaging me on WhatsApp, Signal, iMessage. I don't have an Android, but we're all on Slack all day. And so just the sheer number of pings. And I think like that's why any pain points in these messages make it all the worse, because you're constantly kind of dealing with pings from a million different areas. And if we can whittle that down a little bit, it might make everybody's lives a little bit simpler and some of these decisions the companies make a little less impactful.
Yeah.
Andrew, you're welcome back on the show anytime. I 100% agree. And this reminds me a little bit of our conversations with Jason Kay, who says he likes having crappy phones because of the barrier they create to being on them all the time. Like, he went back to a flip phone at one point,
yep,
and he wasn't getting all these completely irritating notifications.
Yes, he just became the irritating person who didn't respond.
That's correct.
There's one thing about your story that I want to make sure we touch on before we move on, and that's the fact that in this 88-page lawsuit, the DOJ really crafted a narrative in an interesting way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is, from what I understand, based on my limited knowledge of big antitrust cases, that this is definitely part of the strategy, that the Department of Justice wants to make this accessible, not just for the technologists and the technicians. It's a little bit different in that way from the Microsoft antitrust case, which the filing is dated 1998. That went on for years. It's a little bit shorter, but it's highly technical. And especially because back then the consumer internet was still relatively new. And so explaining the intricacies of like super apps and the Netscape browser and how that worked and the default browser on Windows and how Windows saw itself as this like beautiful boutique and everything else was going to bastardize that. And like this is a little bit more like, hey, the common people hate it when their green chat friends break the message, you know, break the thread. This is more like, there are billions of Apple devices around the world. They're some of the most popular products in the world. They're also relatively easy to grok. And so I think that the DOJ is really leaning on that and those widespread consumer experiences to build this narrative around like, hey, we like the DOJ is alleging that there's something anti-competitive happening, but it's presenting it in some parts of the filing. I mean, other parts are incredibly technical, but in some parts of the filing, presenting it as this is something that everyone can understand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have one final question for the both of you. Andrew, I'll ask you this question first. You have done some reporting on this. You've spoken to some experts. What's the word on the street? Who's going to win?
I think Apple has a good chance of winning this lawsuit, to be honest. I think that it's going to be really difficult to prove that they have a monopoly given their market share and that the decisions that they're making that are arguably good for their own customers are demonstrably bad for the rest of us. So, you know, I think just talking about security specifically, you know, definitely part of the reason I own an iPhone is because I'm very security and privacy conscious as Wired security editor. And I value the benefits that that gives me by using that platform. Does my extra security because I bought an iPhone make you, Michael, less secure? Maybe. I don't know. That's a really hard question to answer. And that's, you know, one small part of a bigger legal strategy, but I do think they're going to run into those issues once they get into the nitty gritty and go up against Apple's equally highly paid lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'd also be remiss if we didn't mention the App Store is a big part of this too. And Ben Thompson, who writes the Stratechery blog, he's a tech analyst. He's done a pretty good analysis of this, but that might end up being the DOJ's strongest argument, that some of the policies and the fees that Apple has established in the App Store could be the thing that is most damning, perhaps. And in this case, the DOJ also has the Epic case to lean on a little bit. Apple ended up winning that case, but there could be some prior art there, so to speak, that helps support the DOJ's case.
All right. Well, thanks both. I look forward to texting you without issue in the very near future. Let's take another break and we'll come right back with recommendations. All right, this is the end of our show, our recommendation segment, where we go around the horn and everybody gets to recommend something to our listeners they might enjoy. Andrew, as our guest, you get to go first. What is your recommendation?
So my recommendation is for foodies out there, or anyone who, specifically anyone who really enjoys savory food. I'm not a big dessert person. I would much rather have beef jerky than a cupcake. But this one comes from Italy. It's called Profumo del Chianti. It's basically a sea salt spice mix. But my wife is Italian American and fluent in Italian, worked in Italy a bunch. And she brought this back, from one of her long ago business trips. And it is perhaps my favorite thing. You can put it on vegetables. You can put it on meat. I sometimes just stick my finger in the jar and eat some of it because I'm a weirdo. It is delicious. I highly recommend it.
So is it like granular, like salt, like a seasoning?
It's like, yes, it's like the most finely ground sea salt with various like herbs and some other spices in it. I don't know exactly what's in it. Unlike my wife, I don't read Italian. So whatever's on the ingredients list is still a mystery to me, but it's a delicious mystery.
Very
that
nice.
That sounds amazing. Where do you get it from? Well, it sounds like your wife brought it back from Italy, but if you run out, where do you get it here in the States?
You can just buy it online from various kind of Italian specialty stores. She got it when she, I believe, she got it at the place where they make it, but it's kind of in Parma, I believe, and where there's like Parmigiano Reggiano is made, where there's like prosciutto. Giant. Yeah, it's all in that the world of like delicious savory Italian food. So, but you can buy it online.
Nice.
I'm extremely hungry.
I bet Luca has it.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe. It's like I was gonna say it's like Italian za'atar.
Sounds like it.
Okay, yeah. So I'm gonna be putting that on my avocado toast from now on, most likely. Thank you.
Great call.
Lauren, what's your recommendation?
My recommendation is a very, very late recommendation. Back in 2022, a lot of people were making a fuss about this book. I finally got around to reading it. Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow.
Yes.
Yeah, it's great.
Is it about video games?
It is about video games, but it's really about friendship. It's about a few characters, two in particular, who are childhood friends, and they're, you know, friendship extends into adulthood. It's kind of an on again, off again friendship, but they're also video game collaborators, and it's incredibly touching. It's just good. It's a good read.
Who is the author?
It's written by Gabrielle Zevin.
Nice. Yeah. And so it's out in paperback now, probably.
I have the hardcover because I was ambitiously trying to read it when it first came out, but it's probably out in paperback by now.
Nice. Yeah.
I haven't gone down the rabbit hole on this yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's been optioned to turn into some kind of derivative work, if you will.
Great. I look forward to Netflix 2027.
Yeah. So if anyone has not read Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, probably all of you have. Once again, I'm very behind, you know, when we're not reading 88-page
DOJ filings.
Lawsuit filings, another dissertations for people who write about, you know, all that stuff. I recommend checking it out.
Okay.
Yeah. And Mike, what's your recommendation?
I'm going to recommend Big Ears 2025 because I just got back day before yesterday from attending Big Ears 2024. It's a music festival. It's in Knoxville, Tennessee, which is a lovely city. It's very livable. It's beautiful. The weather's nice. The people are amazing. They have good barbecue. Big Ears is in its 10th year this year, so next year will be the 11th. It is a new music and jazz festival. Big Ears, which just celebrated 10 years in Knoxville, is a festival for music that is sort of like cross-genre music between jazz and Americana and new music. So a lot of like strings, string quartets, but also jazz combos, classical music, singer-songwriter stuff, hip hop, it's all there. And it is a big sort of mush of all these different kinds of music, and there's collaboration. It's not like when you say music festival, people think of like Coachella, right? People think of, okay, there's a big field,
right?
And you pay $30 for parking, yeah, and you walk from stage to stage to stage all day. And, you know, there's all these teenagers on psychedelics.
Yeah.
This is not that. It's closer to a festival like South by Southwest, where it descends on the downtown area of a small city. And there is a number of venues. There's about 10 or 15 venues.
Oh, so the bathrooms are indoors, which is great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. They're all indoors. And you go from venue to venue to venue, and you get a little wristband, little RFID wristband that gets you into any show, you know, every show that's happening. Sometimes they reach capacity and you have to wait, although we didn't run into that problem. It was really wonderful. I got to see a bunch of acts that I've always wanted to see, but have never gotten the opportunity to see because they were all there, and it was really great. So if you're into sort of avant-garde stuff, but you call yourself like a fan of jazz or Americana or bluegrass or new classical music, right? Like modern music, then Big Ears is probably something you already know about. But if you're into that and you haven't heard of it, you should definitely check it out. And it'll be next March, most likely. I mean, I don't even know if there's going to be a 2025. I'm just guessing. If you see it, look into it because it might be your thing. And it's an awesome festival. It's like probably the best music festival I've ever attended.
That's high praise.
Yeah.
High praise and an incredibly on-brand recommendation.
Also, I should mention that I'm in my late 40s and I don't like to be on my feet and I don't like to be like physically uncomfortable. Uh-huh. I was very comfortable the whole time.
Yeah, that's my aversion to music, quote unquote, festivals, whether it's the kind that you're describing where you actually are in venues and you're like meandering around a city, or it's the big open field, you know, with like wristbands and Molly and porta potty. Shudder.
Nope, none of that.
Too old for that. But yeah, my aversion's generally been like it's too many days of really loud music and noise and crowds and stuff. Your experience sounds a lot more pleasant.
Yeah, it was. Also just East Tennessee, lovely place. Great part of the country.
Very cool.
Yeah.
You're going to go work for the tourism board there?
I don't think so.
Are you going to move there?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Because I left California. The greatest state in the union.
Fair.
Okay. Well, thank you, Andrew, for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
Of course. Come back anytime, yes. Especially next time there's a big tech lawsuit from the government.
And we promise not to send you too many notifications, Andrew.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you all for listening. If you have feedback, you can find all of us on the internet somewhere. Just check the show notes. Our producer is Boone Ashworth. We will be back next week with a new show. And until then, goodbye.
Amazing.
I wish Boone had his camera on so you could see his new haircut.
Yeah. Oh, we forgot to say happy birthday to Boone.
Oh, shit.
Put that at the end. Put that at the end.
I stopped recording. Oh, well.
Que los cumplas feliz. Que los cumplas
happy
feliz.
Happy birthday, Boone Man. Come together with me.
Now that the show is over, check out Empower's app we mentioned earlier. With the free Empower dashboard, you can see your net worth, plan out your retirement age, track spending, and more. You can also connect with Empower's financial professionals and get a free second opinion to help with your money questions. Join 18 million Americans and take control of your financial future to empower what's next. Download the free app for Apple and Android devices now or visit empower.com.